podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson with Kieran Molyneux, with Cam Rimmer and with Roberto Gutmann, to give him his full title. As we get ourselves settled in for this one, we're going to be looking back at West Ham, looking ahead to Tottenham Hotspur. And if you listen to this as a podcast, we've got Laura Brown talking about the With Fire and Rage project that's right the way through the city. Dan Hewitt talking about his documentary that screens on ITV at 10:20 on Sunday night. And we've got the writer, director and cast member from Wearing Colours, a play that went off brilliantly last weekend I'll come round to that. I'll remember in a minute or two. But we'll start off with West Ham United. We are live and you've got to take these risks in these sorts of circumstances. We'll talk about the fact that Liverpool were good against West Ham. We'll get on to individuals first and foremost, but I'll come to you first, Keo. The thing I was most delighted about in hindsight was that Liverpool started really well, went a goal behind, 20-yarder, few people could do better in it, goalkeeper included, but also the players in the run-up I think could all do a bit better. And then what happened was Liverpool didn't panic. No one lost their heads. No one went mad. Liverpool weren't terrible. Liverpool didn't act as though they'd never seen a football before. Liverpool didn't act as though they all hated each other. Instead, they just got on with it. And it's the first time that that's happened in a while, and it was great to see.
Yeah, when last time I spoke to you, I think it was Easter weekend, and I was saying to you, I just want to see Liverpool be able to take a punch and throw one back if we go a goal down. And I remember that was before the Arsenal game, but We looked like we had something about us, didn't we? We looked like we picked ourselves up after something bad happened, and we went back at them. And you mentioned some individual performances for this Trent, Jones in particular, who at times I have been critical of in the past. I think he was great. So yeah, positive.
It was positive. You know, Cam, to me, it was an 80-point season performance. And that's, you know, this is not going to be an 80-point season, and Liverpool have got to look at themselves for that in a number of ways, on the pitch and off the pitch and in the transfer markets. Happy to acknowledge that. But it was, all of a sudden, it looked like an 80-point season performance, the like of which we just probably haven't seen, maybe even going all the way back to the World Cup, you know. And I don't, what I mean by that is they've scored 7 against Man United since then. They got the 2-2 draw with Arsenal. They played well, scored 6 at Leeds. They played well in moments and in games and all of that. But it was the most sort of, yeah, this is what just winning a football match is about, performance that I've seen in a while from Liverpool. A difficult away, under the lights, we're going to be all right.
Yeah, it was just the Liverpool of old, wasn't it? And even if we do get to the end of the season, we fall short of fourth. If all the rest of the season's like this, it sets the precedent for next season, then, doesn't it? Where, you know, we're not just going to turn next season and think, oh, what might happen? And then just go there, go into places, just calming it down. Like, because a couple of weeks or months ago, we all know what would have happened towards the end of the game there. And in the end, we were able to just see out and stuff. But nah, yeah, I think the performances now are just, the transition's already happening for next season. You're already starting to see what Klopp wants, and then just bleeding in this new sort of side that we've got. And, you know, hopefully if we do get to the end of the season and just see where it takes us, to be honest. But I'm not too sure what's going to happen yet.
No, we've got a... It is still one game at a time, Rob. I mean, some people were calling it the Big Nine, and the streets have been vindicated on that sort of chat, because Liverpool have won the first three of the Big Nine.
But Big Three.
It's been a Big Three, and there's a Big Six to come. But there is, within that, whilst there is the idea of what happens if they do win all nine, and where will that leave them in the table, parking that for a minute or two, in part because of the new shape, but also what that's done for a few individuals within that shape, I thought, you know, what happens against West Ham, specifically start off talking about Jones's performance in there and what Jones has shown since he's got himself back into this side. I think it's so important. It's important for next season. It's important to define what we want from that role. It's important to see what he brings to the role, how it is different to what we've seen before. I thought he was excellent against West Ham. I really did.
Yeah, he was. Is that his fourth consecutive start?
Yeah.
I think it is. It was more of the same in a sense from what we've seen from him. He's becoming a footballer we can rely on to look after the ball, to keep us in possession.
High up the pitch as well. He's not doing it on the halfway line. He's doing it closest to their box.
No, he's allowed to pick the ball up deep, and he's good with his back to goal, I've noticed. In that Wijnaldum sense, that's the obvious comparison, I think, even though their body shapes are different. But he is clearly being given license to get further forward in this sort of three-ish formation we're playing. I'm not one of those who goes, I was getting doubtful about him, but I'm glad he's back. I've always been his biggest fan.
You love him?
I love him because...
So I was holding back when Keo mentioned him before. I was like, Keo, just hang on there a minute, because Rob's going to go mad for him in a second.
I, I'm one of those dorks who watched him back in the youth sides back in the day, and he was just a level above. He'd run games. He was a very offensive player, scored a shitload of goals. I remember him scoring four in a game, and virtually all four were dribbles, and then twatting them in from the edge of the box. One for the kids, a Roy of the Rovers stuff. He broke into the team really quite dramatically with that goal against Everton. And it sort of set a bit of a bar for himself, really, that he was going to be this very creative player who would have goals and assists in his locker. And I still think he's got that. I think he has threatened it in the first team in a mini sustained basis last year against Brentford and Porto.
Yeah,
I don't think we're yet seeing that higher level Curtis yet, but this level of Curtis more than deserves his place. And even if we'd never seen him play before, you go, and we just bought this 22-year-old in, you go, he's a prospect, isn't he? You know, if he was called Curtis Gravenberch or something like that. I don't know. I'm being flippant about it, but I think he's still got a very, very high ceiling. It's probably a bit too soon to acclaim his full complete renaissance, but he definitely has, I think, ended speculation that this would be his last season at Liverpool by some distance.
Yeah, it's important, not because there's a thing that happens here, I think, where you don't want to get carried away on the one hand, but it's also important not to damn with faint praise in another. Liverpool have changed their approach markedly, and a big part of that has been Curtis Jones. You know, if he wasn't available to play this role the way in which he's playing it, there's maybe a conversation to be had when you now look at what Liverpool business might be in the summer, that they've got no one else who can sort of do it the way in which he does it, that high up the pitch, with his back to goal, as Rob says, looking after it, the idea he can go outside Jota, which you saw on a few occasions as well, maintain possession, hold possession, not necessarily putting the best ball you've ever seen, but that's back to sort of the faint praise thing. That doesn't matter. You're getting to see his role in the team, and I think he's doing it expertly.
Yeah, four starts on the bounce screams that, and Klopp's been complimentary of him, hasn't he, in the press conference for this weekend. And I think, I was, when I say I've been critical of him in the past, when Rob said there he's 22 years of age, and if you just brought him in and based him on these four games, you'd be thinking, what a hell of a prospect. And that's right. And we should be judging players based on how they're performing, because we've been screaming for players to dig deep and to pull us out of this and to change things and change how we play up the pitch, up the other end of the pitch. So fair play to him. And I think when he signed a new deal, I think that was him definitely getting a bit more time anyway. And obviously securing a bit of resale value in the future should things not work out. But yeah, I'm made up with him. I think he'll start again at the weekend, and long may it continue, because he's a young player and he's got bags of potential.
The next phase for it is, as Cam's saying, maybe just a teeny little bit more when he gets himself around the area, Cam. Not least because what you don't want is to become the sort of footballer where the opposition think, you know what, he's not going to try anything. But he's still doing the flicks here and there. And I think there's like a line here where you need him to feel like a genuine threat around the penalty area, just simply because it drags people. And there's a thing that the way the Liverpool using him, you know, he gets them all the way up, as I say again, so 20, 25 yards away from the opposition goal, looks after the ball. And there might be some people who think, well, he's holding on to it for a minute. But part of what then happens is Liverpool push all the way up. Trent gets himself into position as well. And the opposition fall all the way back because they're thinking to themselves, well, we need numbers here, because Liverpool have just got themselves a master around our penalty area. And that's what I think he's been doing brilliantly. You know, he's been getting Liverpool up the pitch, holding the ball, and then we're able to start again when he gets there.
Yeah, that's the difference exactly between, like, when he's playing in the academy, as Rob was saying, you see the clips where he's taking a pass four or five men and then just taking her on because he's levels above everyone else on the pitch. But when he's playing, you know, Premier League level, and then, as you said, you've got your Trents coming around him, Robbo's on the other side, and then your front threes, it's obviously at that level, it's going to be hard for him, but also there's better players around him just past you anyway. So now it's just a case of, I still think there's a lot more from him to come. I just think you can just tell by him as a person as well. You can tell he's got a lot of confidence in himself to go and have a pop, but this is obviously being told by Klopp. He'll just come in time. I still always think I know he did get that. He literally did get that big goal I'm going to talk about when he first came through against Everton. But I still feel like it's going to be a time, like probably next season now, where he'll get like some sort of goal and he'll be like, I'm here sort of thing. I think that goal against Everton was probably a bit too early. But yeah, I think he's going to be totally fine, and interested to see whereabouts he's going to fit in the next couple of seasons, hopefully.
The player who's fitting now and redefining this, Rob, is Trent, who's been... You know, it's now much talked about the shifting role. But I think the most important part of the shifting role remains the consistency of quality. And you got to see it again against West Ham United. Ability to move the ball. They had a bit of a plan for it. Again, another side that's had a bit of a plan for it. I think that the same could be said of the previous opponents as well last weekend, where they had a bit of a plan for it as well, Nottingham Forest, but Liverpool still found a way to make it work. Liverpool make it work against West Ham one more time, and we're not as vulnerable as I was concerned we might be as well, especially given the fact that, you know, Matip deputised for Konate. I felt as though it worked pretty well in the grand scheme of things.
It did. I'm sort of waiting for where the sting in the tail is, where we look vulnerable, because in a certain sense, we've taken a player who was considered to be too inclined to be further up the pitch, helping out the attack, leaving himself exposed on the counter and always having to leg it back, to saying to him, you know, that defensive responsibility element of your game, which was maybe 50% before, it's now down to about 10%. And you think, oh, fuck me, we're dragging a centre-half across. It feels fraught with danger. And yet, it seems to be working pretty well. Look, I'm being flippant. There's a reason why, because there's many more bodies now in the centre of the pitch who are able to apply a pressure much earlier, especially, I think, what's important is the two eights, Curtis and Jordan, I think, who are able to apply, along with a defensive front three, if you like, with personnel like Jota and Gakpo. So, and even Salah is a strong defensive player. So we're defending with a front five, really. Five Lallana-type forwards, in a certain sense. And that, I think, is why we're not coming under great stress. And I think what we're left with is Trent playing, ostensibly, as a midfield player. We can talk all day long about him having duties to perform at right back. Which he does, but...
And that's a starting position.
It is a starting position.
He is a right back.
I'm just not really, but I think we're beginning to play with... I think we're really at the cusp of football semantics here, where we go, no, he's a this, but he's got license to do that. No, he's a midfielder who is given some encouragement when out of the ball to fill in at right back.
I think he's a right back.
I don't know. Watching him with each passing game, he seemed to be more and more central, and much less occasion where you saw him just stand in a right back position. Many less occasion. Far, far less. I haven't seen the heat maps. I don't know what tale they'd tell. But also
the one that he's a right back who's cutting in.
Yeah, he's playing in midfield a lot. And also he's not just playing as a six in midfield, he's playing as an eight in midfield a lot of the time as well. This is a midfielder who's got defensive duties. It's not the other way. And I'm not having it anyway. We'll see how
he is a right back.
We could have argued a couple of years ago that he was a winger with right back duties then.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a wing back,
when he was slightly off the pitch. I think it's a right back who's coming into midfield when we've got the ball. When we haven't, he knows that there's definitely going to be something to do within this game at right back. And it's working. It seems to be working fine.
Neil's going to show me some heat maps and stats things. I'm going to disbelieve whatever.
No, you're going to quite like them. I'm actually bringing them in so that you can say he is tucked in. He plays in a line with Henderson and with Matip in there as well, because that is what's happening. But that's where he's getting on the ball, and that's where he's passing to and from. The point is more, it's about what he's arriving into, but that... You've still got to allow for where he's starting from, if you see what I mean. I think that's a really important, going to be an important point on this and in and around all of this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Because we're not saying, for instance, in the same heat map thing where that is, you could say that Curtis Jones is playing left wing, because that's where he gets on the ball. He gets on the ball wider than Jota in an average position sense.
Yeah.
But we don't think he's playing left wing, really, do we? We think he's playing as an eight.
No, yeah, but it's
basically, actually, I mean, I'm not arguing with you, really. It's more that Gary Lineker can fuck off.
Yeah.
That's my eventual position on this. So you're just a proxy for Gary Lineker at this point in time, who was raving about him on Match of the Day, the midweek, saying that's exactly what he should always have been doing, as though he hadn't won every trophy in world football as a right-back and is still a right-back.
I think this is one of those cases where we all are going to have to accept a few things can be true at the same time. One of them may be that he's playing right-back in midfield. But one of the things... But two of the things that are true at the same time, if I can expand this principle... He may for a while have been, and may he still have it in him to be the greatest right back and have reinvented the right back role and should always have played there during one of the greatest phases of Liverpool Football Club's history. And at the same time, be ready to become one of Liverpool's greatest midfielders of all time. Both those things could yet prove true. And I don't think we should sit on, we shouldn't be fighting get the Gary Lineker wars. Let's just see how it evolves. I think the main thing is...
I'm always fighting the Gary Lineker wars.
One thing I do feel is he's got...
Like the Daily Mail. Not the Conservative and Unionist Party.
Here we go. he just seems to have much greater freedom. I said to you, I think we were stood at Leeds, and I said, I don't know what whatever you want to call this. It's a in old money they used to sometimes go, he's got a free roll, that lad, hasn't he? It's just where's his starting point for this free roll?
He could be a right half back.
Yeah,
there we are. We'll take that back from the 1960s position. Yeah, the 19th century football. Kia, whatever it is, first and foremost, it is excellent. And the most important thing for me on the ins and outs of it is that it's about his quality. It works because of his quality. His quality is the most important part of this. And I think too often this season I've watched Liverpool teams and I've felt a bit like I don't understand how what we think we're doing is getting the best out of our best players. Right now, especially where this player is concerned, who I think is one of our very, very best players, you can see how we are getting the best out of this one of our best players in Trent.
Yeah, and if we're going to be honest, I don't really care what label we put on it, as long as he's playing brilliantly and he can cover defensively when he needs to. It's his passing, Neil. The passing is like, Liverpool have had some great passes over the years, and I think if he keeps playing this position over the next two, we're going to see another one of Liverpool's best ever passes of the ball. His vision is unbelievable, the way he cuts through, the way he's finding Gakpo, which I'm sure we're going to get on to in a minute, because he's just absolutely brilliant. But yeah, I'm made up with Trent, I think, and I thought long may it continue. Like Rob said, he definitely should have been where he played during that period of Liverpool's history, but going forward, it seems to be we're onto something. Things are working, and I say for me, it's the passing. Obviously, and the other contributions he's making, but he's really shining.
Cam, with him, I mean, we'll go on to Gakpo actually, as Keo mentions him there. I think it's another really good performance. It's not just the goal against West Ham. I felt like when Liverpool in the early part of the game were the better side, I thought you saw him be part of that with his movements, the ability again to lead the press. I think he's playing really nicely now in the middle of that pitch, and you can see exactly what Liverpool have invested in.
Yeah, and I think it's just as well when he is going back in to cover times, he just looks more relaxed because he's just got that freedom now. But then, you know, it's, as you said, like the stuff off the ball, but yeah, his performance is just getting a lot better as the season's going on. But when he is in the middle, as Keir was saying, like the passing's just unbelievable. Like the one for Gakpo as well, it was just like at the time you don't really appreciate it. It's when you're watching it back and it's like this, like it's such a good, like it's just so instinctive and just like, wow, this is something really, really special. But you're watching, and just long may it continue now, to be honest, because I think now like this new role, people could start calling it like the Trent we've all just been arguing for 5 minutes saying, but what is it? But it's you know, it's just you don't really know what to call it at the minute. It's just Trent.
Well, go on.
I was nudging you just while we were a second ago. If you take the heat map on that we've been talking about, I don't know if people can't see this.
I can help them see
What's interesting about it is if you took the names away, it actually looks like we're lining up with our front three and our fullbacks very high up the pitch. But if you then put the names in, you'd have Curtis Jones and Mohamed Salah as your left and right wing backs in the Robertson and Robertson and Trent roles, and your front three in the furthest forward in that game, and only marginally so in Jordan Henderson's case, but Jota, Cody Gakpo and Jordan Henderson as a kind of front three are playing very, very close together with defensive width coming from Mo Salah and Curtis Jones. It is quite fascinating to see.
And he's got it there. If you are watching this on YouTube, you can see it all the way through. Jones to the left of Jota, Gakpo through the middle, Henderson to the left of Salah to the right, and then Fabinho and Trent, Robertson out on that left-hand side. I think part of this, Cam, to me, is it does feel like a little bit like seeing Liverpool 2023-2024 all of a sudden. And that's what's, you know, regardless of what happens with the games between now and the end of the campaign, that's what wasn't happening in January, February and March. Almost take the results away, if you see what I mean. In January, February and March, you felt like you were watching a side that was still trying to work out what on earth it was and what was going on. Right now, you feel like you're watching a team. And that includes, by the way, a period of time where Liverpool put 7 past Manchester United. To be really clear, this is not just when it goes wrong. Even when it went right, it was still a little bit like a team that's trying to find itself. Right now, Cam, is you do feel as though wherever the personnel end up, as Rob says, whatever names end up, wherever that is on the heat map, you feel like you're seeing what Liverpool are going to be about 2023 going into 2024. But seeing next season's Liverpool now.
Yeah, I mean, without going into the whole midfielder debate, you can kind of see with one or two signs coming in, how we're probably going to line up on the first game of next season in terms of like the positions and stuff. But it's all came since Trent has you know, with this change in trend, where it just all to seem to have just happened, this one little change in the system, and everyone else just looks so much more composed and assured. And now you're thinking, like, if we'd done it earlier on in the season, what could have happened? Do you know what I mean? That's the one little thing there where it's like, well, you know, but you can always look at everything. Like,
they may have been working on it. I mean, one of the things I think is maybe they've been working on it and finally he's thought, right, I can give this a go. I always remember a lot of people feeling like when he had Phillips and Williams at centre-half in the COVID season, and there was all a bit of thinking, but why didn't he just do that earlier? But maybe he was just working with them loads and training and working with everyone as the best way to do this, and then he introduced it at the right time. Just sort of know what I mean. I don't think it may well be that it's just now come to fruition in terms of what he's seeing off the pitch, off the 3 p.m. pitch, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree, because, like, it couldn't have got any worse when he brought her in. You know what I mean? So it's like, in that case, but yeah, I'd probably back you on that, to be honest. I think that's what's happened, and just hopefully, as again, like I said before, just sets a standard for next season now, doesn't it? In terms of how we're lining up and stuff and the results we're getting.
Excellent stuff. This is Tour Live. If you've been enjoying it so far, thank you very much indeed. If you're enjoying it as a live, we're going to leap straight into part five. But if you are listening to it as a podcast, we've got Laura Brown talking about With Fire and Rage. We've got Dan Hewitt on his ITV documentary, Current Affairs Stuff, on Sunday night at 10:20 p.m. And Wearing Colours from Sidehammer Productions was on at the Hope Street Theatre last week. And I've got the writer and the director and a cast member from there all joining us as well. That's coming up now on Tour Live if you're listening as a podcast. I'm joined by Laura Brown to talk about the project you've been working on, With Fire and Rage. With Fire and Rage, bring stories from Ukraine's artists to Liverpool. It's an immersive audio tour as part of the everything that's going on around Eurovision, the Euro Festival that is happening. So, ultimately, Laura, the floor is indeed yours to explain what With Fire and Rage, what it is, and how people can enjoy and engage with it.
Okay, so it's began actually as a conversation between two of the producers, Zoe Lafferty and the Ukraine-based producer Veronika Skilarova. And it was exploring how, while the wonderful festivities of Eurovision are in Liverpool, we could encourage people in Liverpool to have an understanding of what is happening to the artist community in Ukraine. And that started with a visit to meet a lot of the artists, sort of travelling to different cities and making a list of the artists that you would want to hear from. Because the idea is that it's easy, I think, a lot of the time for you to see things on the news and to hear headlines and hear a personal story, but not think about how fundamentally life changes for people. So what you will be able to do is go to 10 different locations across Liverpool city centre. You will see a poster that has With Fire and Rage on it. You will read a little story, a little bit of text with some beautiful artwork that's been made by a Ukrainian graphic designer, Katya, who I think I've slowly driven mad throughout the whole of this process. And you scan a QR code and you will hear the testimony of an artist from Ukraine. You will hear a little bit of poetry as well, and you will hear a little bit of writing. And each of the stories kind of gently links to the location. So it starts in the Everyman, goes to the Philharmonic.
So is there an order? So people want to do this?
There is, but I'm really conscious that people sort of do stuff with their own thing in mind. If you're sitting in the Blue Coat Garden, you go, I wonder what that is, and you scan and you listen to the story, you will not lose anything at all. You can start at the Everyman and walk all the way down to Liverpool Parish Church and listen to every single one, or you can just do one or two. And that was very much what we wanted to do. And it's... Do you know, the weird thing was that the best way I thought to describe it, I listened to a guy who's a journalist from Mariupol, and he was talking about how weird he felt when he came to Liverpool, because he said Liverpool is really like what Mariupol used to be like. There's a really vibrant, you know, blistering creative community that's quite loud and can be quite abrasive and is very full of itself. And you think about what Liverpool would be like if the city was flattened and that creative community was having to fight on a front line or was having to move somewhere else. And I think it's those kind of experiences of that are really powerful. But there's also another side of it. Zoe and I were walking through Liverpool the other week, and one of the things we were talking about is when you are invaded, the thing that people want to destroy is your culture and your identity. So you defending and defining your culture is as much resistance as anything else. there are artists that are putting together Molotov cocktails and putting them in theatres. But sometimes protecting Ukrainian language, protecting Ukrainian poetry is as much a form of resistance as anything else.
When, and that's part of the reason why it is called With Fire and Rage, when you're working on this in this sort of cross-city way, cross-border way as well, and working with a number of, because let's be clear about this, it's 40 artists from Ukraine who are featured in the work, you know, give or take a couple in either direction. There's bits and pieces of stuff from Kharkiv metro station underground, people who've left the stage to go and fight on the front line, and bits and pieces. All of this stuff's in there all the way through this work. When you're trying to pull that together, and as I say, it's interesting that it's a linear piece, but which can be enjoyed in a non-linear context. It's also a collaborative piece where many of the collaborators don't get to properly meet with one another. I don't just mean in person, I also mean remotely at times. How important, therefore, is the guiding intelligence of Zoe, of Veronica, in amongst that idea of, right, how do we keep this so that it can both stand alone, how it's collaborative, how this stuff's unique? How do you keep that sort of the primal energies that you need the pieces to have in the context of the fact that you still need it to feel as though it's a collaborative piece of work?
I think Veronica... Basically, I mean, Veronica is living in Ukraine. She's coming over for a bit of Eurovision. And she's the narrator of the piece as well. So when you're listening, you hear Veronica. And she actually says a few times, I've never been to Liverpool. So I'm guiding you through a city without having seen it. And we've sort of walked through the streets and said to her, you know, that's been a really important process of, you know, one of the places is news from nowhere.
But so she's collaborating with a place she's never been to.
Yes. Yeah.
And projecting onto a place that she's never been to. So you have to therefore report back to her so that she understands that exactly what it is that she's trying to achieve. And that's a complicated thing.
It is. But I think there's a lot of women working on the project semi-accidentally. But I think one of the things that women are always very, very aware of place, and they're very aware of what place feels like. I think there are men like Will Self that call this psychogeography. I'm not really into that sort of vibe in many ways, but you know how you feel in different places in the city. You know where there are places of calm. You know where there are places of, you know, what are the places we've got is the bombed out church. And one of the things I said to Veronica is that's where all the Liverpool fans go when we win the Champions League. And she really liked that sense of, you know, it's where all the you'll often see people with Palestinian scarves and flags because it's a place where we go to protest. And she loved that kind of a thing. So it's about, while Ukraine has been sharing stories with us to share on the streets, we've been sharing stories from Liverpool to kind of go, this is what our city feels like as well. So it becomes a sort of flow of ideas and experiences. And I hope that when people listen to it, because you can plug it, if you want, you can go to the Everyman, plug in and have like about an hour and a half walking and just immerse yourself in the whole thing in one whole go. And I hope what it does is you will be looking around Liverpool, but you will be feeling a sense of Ukraine as well inside.
It begins at the Everyman, moves forward into the Philharmonic Hall, St. Luke's, /Bombed Out Church, obviously. News from Nowhere, Blue Coats, Central Library, Lovelocks, Moorfields, and Liverpool Parish Church, if you did indeed want to do it in an order, and about an hour and a half, as Laura says, all the way through. And it is part of the wider Eurovision thing. That's literally part of why you've committed to it in this way. And there's a real desire, isn't there, I think, for the city to feel like it has that connection with Ukraine for the period of this, so it's first to the 14th, Eurovision itself's on the 13th. There might be some people listening to this who either themselves are coming to the city or are sort of know people who are going to come to the city for part of this period of time, to be part of the whole sort of Eurovision experience. This is something that people can enjoy. It gets them right the way across the city as part of the fortnightly period.
Yeah, definitely do. And it's free. And I think that's really, you know, a key thing. One of the things we said is, you know, make sure your smartphone's charged. Have your headphones with you. One of the things we are going to do is we are going to buy some charging points. So we'll have you'll find this out. When you go onto the website with fireandrage.com, you'll be able to sort of find out where different things are, like, you know, chargers stashed behind reception desks and that kind of a thing. But it's designed for you to have a bit of a moment to yourself, because I think, you know, Eurovision's a party. And all of us who have ever engaged with Eurovision over the years, we never sort of dreamed it would be in our own city. We never dreamed it'd be under circumstances like this either. And I think, you know, we are hosting it on behalf of Ukraine. And that sense of, I think about this a lot because as somebody who works a lot with Arab artists as well and somebody who is half Palestinian, saying the word is really important because that is what keeps culture alive. So I think the more we say Ukraine throughout Eurovision, the more you have that opportunity to be able to articulate why it's so important that you keep saying it and you keep emphasising it.
Okay, with fireandrage.com for everything else that you need across that as well. We'll be tweeting some stuff out. You can find it also on Twitter, Artists Frontline, in there as well, Artists on the Frontline, on Instagram, everything that you need. But it's those locations, slap bang in the city centre from top to bottom. It's nice that they planned it so you walk downhill. That's no accident.
I'm not. It's not my first time doing an audio tour. Do you know what I mean? Point it towards the river.
Have them tumble all the way down. It's great to speak to Laura. Do get involved. Joined by Dan Hewitt. You'll have heard Dan on much of our Anfield Rap content. Less so these days because, unfortunately, West Bromwich Albion are in the Championship. But when they're in the Premier League, Dan came, talked to us a lot about what's happening at Albion. He still talks to us now they're in the Championship. It's just, you know, we're also Premier League focused, aren't we? But ultimately, that is his sideline. Not even a sideline. That's the thing he does to enjoy himself. And we're using the words enjoy there and stretching it massively. Yes, indeed. But what he does full-time is brilliant work for ITV News. He has, on Sunday, the 30th of April, at 20 past 10 p.m. a documentary called Life and Death Stories from the Edge. Dan, we had you on last time. You had an extended documentary piece and it was around the conditions that many people in this country are forced to live in. This is obviously building on from that work. What made you decide that you wanted to look at the cost of living crisis and the fall in living standards that's happening to so many people in this country?
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And yeah, you're right to question your use of the word enjoy with West Bromwich Albion. That was absolutely the wrong word to use. For me, this is a moment in history, really. You talked about the fall in living standards. We are right now living through the biggest fall in living standards in Britain since records began, since the 1950s. And I think through other, how economies work, you have downturns, you have recessions, and they kind of come and go. And people, frankly, unfortunately, who always struggle a bit more in those recessions. I think most people kind of cut back and work a bit harder and tighten their belt and get through. I think this crisis is unique in the sense that it's cast a much wider net because of the tidal wave of price increase we've seen across the board. I mean, no one has been immune from the increase in energy bills at the same time as the increase in food, at the same time as the increase in interest rates, which has not been a huge knock-on for people's rents. And so for us, we felt it was important to document this quite significant moment in history where we know that millions of people, and in some cases millions of people who've never really struggled quite like this before, are finding themselves in pretty awful situations, in some cases making impossible choices, and in some cases with almost nothing they can do about it. I mean, how do you tell someone who's working full time, whose energy bills have gone up by £200, whose rent's gone up by £200, whose food bill's gone up by £100, to work harder when they're already working full time with three kids? I mean, how do you do that? So we wanted to kind of see the real impact of what us journalists call the cost of living crisis, which can kind of wash over you when you've heard it on the news a lot. So we thought it was important to stand back and properly look at the impact.
I mean, you've sent me a press release. I haven't seen the documentary. I'm sure you're still working on it and pulling it together because I know how these things tend to work. But there was bits and pieces in there of people you were quoting. Izzy Geraghty-Moran, as an example, where you were talking about what she doesn't want to see her kids going through within there as well, as part of this. And then a nine-year-old noticing what it is that she's going through. That was one of the things that stood out to me in the press release that you sent over. And a significant part of this is also, as you say, you know, in the past, a lot of crises that have happened in Britain, 1980s, 1990s, you're able to look at a picture of, for instance, huge and rising unemployment. That isn't the case around this crisis at all. If anything, you know, the unemployment rate has never been so low. And yet the number of people who are in crisis proportionally feels as though it's never been as high.
That's exactly it. And we're talking here in the documentary fundamentally sort of predominantly focuses on kind of what we call almost the working poor, but also people that would never really class themselves as poor, perhaps until maybe 7 or 8 months ago when they started to see that kind of tidal wave of price increases. And I think that is why we were so keen to really dig into this in a documentary rather than just a news report, which we've done quite a lot on, which is how do you cope when your bills have gone up by £400-£500 a month and you're already doing all the things the government say to do, right? The government always say work is the root out of poverty. Well, the fact is 2/3 of people in poverty are in work. And so what do you say to those people? Now, in one of the examples in our documentary, we meet a grandmother called Dee. She already works full time for a national charity. And her bills went up by £400 a month before food. She's living right on the edge and has now just decided a few weeks ago, and well, not decided, she's been forced to take on a second job at McDonald's. So now she works 5 days a week in her full-time job and she works weekends at McDonald's. She's doing 60-hour weeks at a time in her life when she's got grandchildren, she has arthritis as well. She's thinking a couple of years ago about retiring, about what her life would be like when she finishes work. Now she's taking on more work. That is her only way out of this crisis, to try and keep kind of the wolf from the door. You have other people, though, who can't do that. I mean, anyone with kids will know the idea of working more hours when you're already working full time and struggling to see them anyway is not a not an option. And so what you then have is, in some cases, some pretty extreme situations occurring. So we went to a primary school in Halifax, and you'll know that schools are a lifeline for many families. Free school breakfasts are very common in modern Britain, as are free school meals, and even people lending pupils uniforms, teachers lending pupils uniforms. This school in Halifax have started loaning their parents money to pay for energy bills. Parents coming to them and saying, I cannot put the gas on, I can't put the electric on. Children coming to school cold because their parents can't afford it. And so the school are lending their parents money. I mean, that is where we are now. And so there are, in some cases, some pretty extreme examples in the documentary of the kind of problems that are occurring when you have an economy dip so fast and so sharply.
I'm fortunate, Dan, in that I get to do the Anfield Wrap. In lots of ways, I'm fortunate I get to do the Anfield Wrap, but it means I can give my opinion about matters pretty freely. You work for ITV News, and the way in which you're perceived around that stuff matters, and it's difficult. What I would mark out, though, and I want to give you at least some opportunity to speak to, is just in what you've said there. I've read the press release around this, like I said, the work that you did around the housing crisis. It feels to me as though you are, as someone who is going up close and reporting on this, you are exceptionally angry about these situations. That's what comes over when I go through this work of yours. Whilst you're trying to keep your professional distance, it feels to me as though you are exceptionally angry about the situation that a huge quantity of normal people have found themselves in. Is it difficult to process that through the work, or do you just think that effectively doing the work of telling the stories allows you to give voice to your feelings around that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, you're right to point out I work for ITV, and therefore a sort of Ofcom regulated means my opinions are going to be left for probably a chat in the pub with you at some point rather than on this podcast. But I think for me, two things. One, you mentioned the word voice. For me, so much, and I worked in Westminster for a long time, and we give a lot of airtime to a lot of people whose voices I don't really think we should be hearing that much from. And actually, people who are doing all they can to feed their families and feed themselves and doing the best, I think they're the people we should be giving a lot more of a voice to. I think that if anything, my role as a journalist,
it's always been ITV's remit.
Absolutely, and I'm very fortunate to work for a channel that have given me the time and space to do films where actually we are spending a lot of time. I mean, 1 hour on Sunday night will be dedicated purely to working people and working families. There's not a single politician in there, a single talking head, an expert, no one from the Bank of England. This is just people living their lives, telling us what they're going through. And yeah, I do get angry about it, because I think when you're younger and you're growing up and you go to school and you're always told if you work hard, if you knuckle down, if you do all the right things, then you'll be okay. And I found with the housing crisis that we reported on, and now finding with this cost of living crisis, that isn't true. That's not true. I mean, you can do all the right things. You can work hard. You can knuckle down, and still it isn't enough, because it seems in some cases the odds are stacked against people. And I back in October, I spent some time in North Shields up in Newcastle, a brilliant community up there, the Meadowell Estate, and met a great bloke called Neil who runs a family butcher's, and he took over from his grandma, opened it in the 1950s, and proper Geordie. And and he was struggling to keep the place open. And I went back in February and he's had to close it. His energy bill, the energy bills for his four butcher shops went up from 30 grand a year to 70 grand a year. He can't find 40 grand for a family butcher. That's impossible. He can't do it. So he's closed. He's laid off all his staff. And he was almost in tears talking to me in his empty shop. How's that fair? How's that fair? That Neil's done all the right things. He's paid his taxes. He wakes up at 6 o'clock every morning. He does 12-hour days, 6 days a week. And he's watched his whole life's work washed away by an energy crisis that has absolutely nothing to do with him. And he had no say in at all. So that's why I think it's important to give people a voice. Sometimes I think we're both fortunate to do jobs we both love and in relative comfort. That's not the case for everyone. I think it's important to showcase those people, I think.
Okay. It is an ITV News production for ITV. Wherever you listen to in the world, if you're very clever with VPNs, or if you are in the UK, you will also be able to watch it on ITVX. ITVX is worth paying attention to. There's loads of fantastic stuff on there. Do download it, just have it at your fingertips in any way, shape, or form. A good ITV leads to a good country, as far as I'm concerned. Life and death. Stories from the Edge, Sunday the 30th of April at 20 past 10 on the evening. Do check it out. It's fantastic work from Dan. If it's anything to go by from what he did on the housing work, indeed, it will be must-watch television.
It's Neil Atkinson and LMA in Mechwater, which, by the way, is absolutely thriving, and you should get down to the food hall as well. Surrounded by the director, the writer, and a cast member from Wearing Colours, that was performed at Hope Street Theatre 23rd to the 25th of April. John Dillon wrote it. It was last performed 15 years ago, and John wrote it in the immediate aftermath of what happened at Heysel. It got excellent reviews back then. It'll have excellent reviews this time as well. No shadow of a doubt around that. And it was broadcast on ITV in 1990. John, the idea of this being revived at this stage of proceedings, what did you think when it was first brought to you?
Yeah, well, I haven't bothered with it for 15 years, so, I mean, the idea of getting revived wasn't a problem for me, you know, because I had very little to do with it. I wrote it that long ago. All the work's done by others then. So, you know, you can do what you like. It's one of them. So, no, if you're talking about its pertinence to football today, It's an historical sort of document for people to have a look at. It's the views of four fans that were directly involved in what went on at Heysel. Four very different points of view. And, you know, it's trying to summarise, you know, the actual reaction to it from all people. So you get the sort of like a slightly political angle. The football politics come into it about the UEFA, how it stood at the time, with English fans and English clubs. And also you get the general personal stuff and, you know, the idea of Liverpool coming from a dead place like Liverpool in the 80s, as it was, and what football actually meant to the people, the characters then.
When you wrote it, you know, you are writing it in the immediate aftermath. It's always struck me as this odd thing that sometimes gets shouted at nationally in this country, that people from Liverpool never really talked about or did much around Heysel. So there was loads of stuff that went on in the immediate aftermath that I think gets overlooked and was overlooked. And we've actually discussed some of it elsewhere on the Anfield Wrap, and we'll push that again around the time of the anniversary. But when you were doing it, what within that, you know, it was a hell of a moment to choose to try to pull this together. What was it like for you back then trying to pull this play together?
Well, I never actually went to the game. You know, it's one of the European Cup finals I missed there. I think it was just skins and spent more time in the pub and going to matching them days, actually. So, and it's actually when it was in the pub in the aftermath, where people were talking, there was about four friends, and we had to very, you know, they had distinct views. Fellas were saying things like, "I'm finishing with football," not like that should happen, which is always a very general view at the time. But after a bit of talk, you realise it wasn't the game, it's what went on. And then there was other fellas who were actually sort of like, not really interested in the football, and they took it as, you know, he took it as just a sort of like, as I say in the play, a stamp on the passport, going to a game, just going there. He said there was all these attitudes, and then I just thought it'd be ideal to get this together because of the panic of the media and the actual attacks by the media that were going on strongly at the time. You know, if you remember Thatcher coming out on strong punishment, and then you had Neil McFarlane sort of stepping back and as a sports minister having nothing to do with Liverpool, and things like that went on. It was very sort of, I thought the fans' voices weren't there at all. The voices of the owned people weren't heard at all. And that's why I did it. That's why I wanted to sort of write something. At the time, we were quite active in the community, you know, we were sort of like from the left politically. Yeah. And we'd try and put a left slant on it. And, you know, it was no way an excuse for what went on.
Yeah.
But it was contributing factors to the attitudes that prevailed.
Sean, Sean Ponzini directing this. You're asked to do a buy side hammer to come on with LMA as well. What was it that grabbed you about the material first and foremost, and what grabbed you about the whole production?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a sort of bigger story with Sidehammer sort of evolving in a way of Voxy, who originally put it on. So it's a bit of a family affair for these guys. I've known the family, all the family.
Both sides?
Both sides, yeah, since I was about 11. So one of my best friends is cousins with the lads. And yeah, I think just touching on some of the stuff John said there, you know, really, because when they did come and talk to me about it, I did hum and ha. It's not my background. I've never done theatre.
Have you found it in theatre for the first time?
I really enjoyed it, yeah. I think the difference from what I'm used to from working in television and films is that, obviously, we've rehearsed. We've been working on this for 10 weeks. When you usually got a camera there, you don't have to do that much rehearsal because you can stop the camera and go, actually, can you just... I've thought about this now. Just do this, do that. So what's been a great experience for me is to be able to develop over a longer period of time little moments within the play. And just touching, as I say, on what John said there, you know, I hummed and hawed because of that. But actually what swayed me was the sort of themes and topics covered within the play, you know, things that are as pertinent now as they were then, as they were 15 years ago, unfortunately, you know. So, yeah, you know, we've just had the Champions League final last year and an apology from UEFA, you know, within the play. UEFA have mentioned quite a lot about, you know, their decision-making.
Could you see why the play was so cathartic, though, back then and will be cathartic now as well?
Absolutely, and that's what I mean. It's something I'm hoping, you know, for Liverpool fans and football fans who come to see it, there's that element to it. But also what we have been working hard to do is also that it's something that appeals to, you know, not your match-goer. There's enough in there for people, I think, you know, with the socio-political aspects in there that should appeal to others. So we've been sort of very careful to try and almost not come across as not preachy in terms of this is what happened and this is the real story, but also in times where we touch on elements from different games. There's a lad who's a Celtic fan who talks about going the game to Celtic. You know, we don't want people to come and then come away and go, well, I feel like I've just had a bit of a lecture on football in 1985 and who scored when and who did this. You know, the idea is being it's a bit of a snapshot at society then, which, again, you know, unfortunately, is a snapshot that keeps reoccurring again and time again.
Tom Williamson, part of Sidehammer, but also appearing in the play. Is that a strange sort of experience? You know, you've obviously got to have your hat on from a production point of view, but you've also got to obviously crack on with appearing and being part of the material, working with Sean. How have you found that this time out?
Yeah, no, it's been a strange experience there. For a variety of reasons, me and my brother Dave, who's also starring in the play, we kind of grew up with it because, you know, John's a close family friend, and the Voxy Theatre, which was like my parents' theatre company back in the day, they put this on. So we've grew up around this place. So it's kind of strange being in these roles, and probably strange for John and my dad as well, seeing us, you know, sort of embody these characters that they brought to life back in at the time. In terms of being a producer and an actor in the play, it's not really been that unusual, to be honest, because me and Dave both made the decision when we brought Sean on board, and we thought Sean's perfect for it. You know, he's got he's really, really creative. He's got a lot of experience in TV and production, but he's also just like a good demographic for this play as well. You know, a young lad, Liverpool fan, local lad. So we made the decision when we decided to bring Sean on board that, you know, we were going to hand over basically the reins to him. So since Sean's come on board, me and Dave have just been actors, really. It's just, we've left everything to him in terms of the creative side of it. So
you could get John out of retirement, get him to write another one.
Well, that's always the goal, isn't it? What do you think, John?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, it'd be nice to do something about football.
Have you seen any rehearsal?
No.
You've not seen anything at all? No, so you're going to go in blind and see it for the first
time? Yeah, well, I mean, that's the best way to do it, because, you know, you're part of the audience, then you sort of like this. You're sort of distant from it. And that's the good thing to do. That way, if you're not you haven't got an input there after you've done the script, unless it's for just helping with questions.
Yeah.
You shouldn't really be around. You should let the people drag what they can from it. You know, and the thing is, but if they make a mess of it, it's their fault. And if it's a success, it's down to me.
Are you excited?
You can't lose.
You're excited? First time being performed in over a decade?
I've been excited for years, mate. No. It's just Yeah, I think it's great.
Are you glad they're doing it?
Oh, what else to tell you? You know, I've known, like Tom and Dave, I've known for a while. I've just met Sean now, but I mean, I've got every faith in him. Got the lads, I've known all that. You know, that's the thing about it. You've got to trust people who are going to do something for with your stuff. So, I mean, if you haven't got any trust, then don't bother, because, you know, you might get unhappy somewhere in your life and you want to avoid that at all costs.
Absolutely. So is this, I'm going to come back to you in a second, somebody, you're getting it in the neck in a minute too. But is this a, you know, obviously full size hammer, are you looking to do another stuff? Have you got a plan? Is there an outlook? You mentioned the Voxy and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Are you looking to continue to revive and move in theatre in this way?
We want to produce original work, but we wanted to do it in the vein of the Voxy and continue like what they started back in the 80s. So, like Sean said, any local stories, social political stories, human interest stories, things like that. And we just thought, because we grew up with this play and the Voxy is kind of our inspiration, we thought like this was almost like a flagship show for the Voxy as well. So we wanted this to kind of be our first production to kick us off and then hopefully continue in the same vein, yeah.
Excellent. And are you going to do more theatre? Have you got the bug of theatre, or are you still going to be going back to film and television?
Well, ideally there's a world where you can do both, combine both, yep. You know what I mean? Obviously, first time doing anything like this.
And you've got your LMA work as well.
I've got a lot of LMA work as well. But no, do you know what? I've really enjoyed it. And like the lads were saying before, they have handed off quite a lot to me. I think it probably comes with me being a bit of a control freak, so I think Tom has been quite nice there.
AKA director.
But yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. I think now it's that waiting for Sunday. First night and experiencing that and seeing an audience and what they make of it. So a bit like what John said before, you know, I was waiting to see whether people laughed when they were meant to laugh, cry when they were meant to cry, and they did. So I think it's one of them. Hope to work together again. Look to the future. What's next? And what can we do?
Excellent. Keep an eye out for it. Sideshammer. And this may well get revived again, I think, in the near future as well. Somewhere other than the Hope Street Theatre, although that's a fantastic venue, which you should also keep an eye on as well. Thank you very much to everyone for chipping in here. Keep an eye on Sideshammer. Isn't this all very interesting?
But thank you for staying with us. It is the Anfield Wrap. And we are back with Cam, with Keo, and with Rob to talk about the top four picture and Tottenham Hotspur. Manager Keo was very businesslike in his press conference. It was all about Konate back. We're on the march. Consistency matters. He said this, though, Keo, they'll embrace whatever European competition they end up in. For me, I'm very much the same. I'm sanguine about it as long as they win all the games. And I don't mean that in a sort of in a mad way. I think the most important thing to do is to make Manchester United and Newcastle United earn it at this point from a Liverpool perspective. That's all we can do. And we do that by getting to 71 points. We get to 71 points by winning the rest of the big six. I think we can do it. I think that the fixtures are as kind as we could hope for. But that's the most important thing, isn't it? Whatever happens from this point, all we can do is influence what's in front of us, and we do that just by winning games.
Yeah, we said it 3 games ago, didn't we? Every Liverpool fan said we need to win every single game with a chance. And not just to be in with a chance, to be in with a chance next season. I mean, touched on it before, but if we would have got to the end of the season and didn't know where our best play positions were, our best formation was, we were trying things out, we'd all have a really nervy summer and wonder what team we're going to come back to. Whereas, as Cam touched on before, you can already see now a new system and a new way of playing. So personally, I'm not overly optimistic about getting it, but I just want to see them win every game. And if it happens, then fantastic. But if it doesn't, then Liverpool are on a 9-game unbeaten run, ready to start next season.
That, for me, Rob, that's it. You know, that's what's on offer here is the idea of, let's just say we win the last 9. That's a quarter of a season. And you're able to say, we've just won. And the game 10, the game before, was the 2-2 against Arsenal. You know, you're able to say that was what our last 10 looked like. 1-9, drew 1. 1 against the side that finished above us. Won the other games. As far as I'm concerned, for me, you know, I'm all over the big 9. I always have been. But so is everybody else. Everyone you talk to, that's all the speaking of. But I've been all over it all the way through, thinking it would just be a wonderful way to get into next season, because it'd make us feel like, well, go on then. Let's start. Let's go. Let's do it again.
Yeah. But also sort of, taking the literality of that aside, even if we won 8 of the last 9, and we won, what did we win? 9 of the last 11 in the 21 season. Here's something that people have, I don't know if it's really been absorbed. Let me take a step back. In Liverpool's last 12 Premier League games, we've won 7, drawn 3, lost 2. We're running over the 12 games at a 2 point a game average. If we were to get, if we could win something like 5 of the last 6, we would have played 18 games. My little run, imaginary run, is 18 games, nearly half a season. We'd be running at a mid 85, 86 point average trajectory. So what would have quietly happened is a shit season, the second half of the shit season, Liverpool would have played like a team that could compete for the title. And that's with problems and all. That's without the signings. Now, we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. I actually think we can just stop, pause the picture where we are and go, the 7 wins, 3 draws, 2 defeats from the last 12, which has given us 24 points and a 2 point a game average, is better than the teams we're chasing have been managing all season. I mean, it's easy to take a snapshot. We are, in a sense, it seems strange to call us a form team in the division, considering we've only just won 3, and before there's 4 games without a win. But before then, there was 4 out of 5. There have been some important performances in that. We've started to learn how to win away from home. We've played the two best sides in the country this season. Sorry, not the two best. We played Arsenal, one of the better sides in the season, and nearly beaten them. We beat Man United, who've had a good season, 7-0. We've won away at Newcastle in this run.
Beat them home and away.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and in this run, there's been some away wins. So there is, and we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, because this we've shown ourselves capable of dropping points where it seems incredible that we could. As against Bournemouth, very recent memory, to look at the other side of the coin. Forest looked a game which wasn't always in our control. So I don't think we can be writing the story of the second half of the season just yet. But the portents are a lot better than they were. And I'm on board with the idea that just a strong finish we should be happy with. Let's have a proper tilt at that UEFA Cup and get up for those Thursday nights. But are we going to go on to talk about the actual chances of getting top 4? Because I'm all in it for that stuff.
I'm going to Cam first, but I will come back to you. We need favours, Cam. We know we need favours. But we got a little bit of one from this weekend's opponents. Snookers, indeed. We got a little bit of one from this weekend's opponents last night against Manchester United, where second half they showed some of the quality. But they showed also a little bit of United's vulnerability. I think there is some vulnerability in United, that it's a mini-injury crisis. There's nothing worse than having injuries at centre-half. We know that better than anyone. And, you know, yes, Newcastle were up against, you know, strong relegation candidates, but they did the business that they needed to do in what was a difficult environment to play football, but they managed to quiet and silence the crowds of those relegation candidates and sent them home early. The truth is that, you know, Newcastle do look like they've got the bit between the teeth, to be fair to them, but they don't know the course and distance. They haven't done this before. United have got a little bit of course and distance within them, but they look a little flaky at the moment. But we know we need favours, and those favours just may not come.
Yeah. We could be sitting here in a few weeks and it just doesn't happen. Or we could be sitting here in a few weeks and United and Newcastle have just probably just blown it. But with me, you've just got to look at us now. It's one of them. Like, we've been looking over our backs. We've, like, you know, for the last couple of years, we've been relying on the whole league to get something against City from March onwards. So now it's just a case of, you know, I'm not really expecting anything, because it never really seems to happen, to be honest. But, you know, we just keep winning our games, and then, you know, hopefully we come off the ground in a couple of weeks and United or Newcastle have dropped points here or there.
It's a big three now for Liverpool, Robert. Three homes within there. I think we'll have a real sense as to what is or isn't possible for us. The other side of the game against Brentford, or more accurately, the Monday, Tuesday after the game against Brentford, because yeah, the fixtures are spread across that weekend. But for me, we will have a sense of it then. There's a reason why United and Newcastle, I would say, well, Manchester United and Newcastle United, more accurately, are both going for, are both in the third and fourth place, and not for the first and second places, because they don't win every week. And I think that is worth bearing in mind, even at the minute where they do look like there might be a little bit of momentum around Newcastle. Yeah, but they haven't won every week. They haven't won every single time they're up to the pitch. They, you know, they've only just recently got to the point they've won half the games they're taking to the pitch. That could go the other way again. You know, it's still only 17 wins from the 32 that they've played. I feel as though there is, you know, Liverpool have got to just do their bit. And then from there, you never know.
It was always, in sort of analysing this four games back, where when we talked about the big nine and needing to win all nine, the thing that gave us optimists an inkling of hope was the fact that we weren't just chasing down one team with a half-decent lead, but two. And I remember saying, well, the odds are they both don't just trundle along as they have been doing. One'll hit their stripes and one could flake out. But that's, you know, that's a fight. That's a sporting chance. I still stand by, even though it looks still looks a mountain in a certain sense, I still stand by the idea that if we do our bit, we win our matches, that one of them will deliver. One of them will deliver.
Or not deliver.
Which one? Do you know, it's hard to...
Which one, says Keogh? Go on, Rob.
It changes by the week. At the moment, the clever money's got to be on United to be the fuck-up candidates, or the fuck-up kings. But they've both got flakiness in them, as have we.
The interesting United thing from the grand scheme is that Newcastle can finish above us with 71 points. United can finish above us with 72. The only 72, and that our goal difference will be better than United's.
Yeah, Newcastle have been hitting goals.
Well, Newcastle have A, been hitting goals, but also B, there's the gap in there now. They've got an 8-goal gap on us. We could turn that around possibly, but it's more for me the idea that if the cock-ups come from a United point of view, they need to get all the way to the 72-point mark, not the 71-point mark, and that for me is good news for us.
It is, but I would say on the Newcastle goal difference, well, we could do without them hitting another three and another four in the next couple of games.
Home against Southampton next.
But if we were to catch them without doing the detailed maths, of their six remaining, they're probably not winning more than two of those remaining six. Therefore, we are we're assuming we're winning our games. We're gaining goal difference on them on four games at least on the bounce. So I think we would see them off for goal difference if the results went the way we wanted.
We will see, indeed. Keogh, how are you feeling about it, first and foremost, about Liverpool's chances of just enjoying the rest of this season? Because I think one of the things is the players are enjoying it, and how are you feeling about the big picture if we can do the business?
Well, as I said before, I'm not overly confident about getting in the European Cup, even though it's for me, a big problem if we don't in terms of our next season might look. But I just want to win 9 games. If we win the last 9 games on the bounce, I'll be happy and I'll be looking forward to next season. If it goes back to the way it was and we don't pick up the result this weekend and we don't look great next week, and that will just do me head in. So it will big time.
No, genuinely, my biggest relief with Liverpool at the minute, Keogh, is they've stopped doing my head in.
Yeah, exactly. So chances of it happening, I'm not sure. It'd be fantastic, wouldn't it, to after some of Ten Hag's comments to catch United and they drop out of it. But for me, it's about getting our house sorted first. And this season has been a proper head wrecker. So let's just finish the season strong. And if it happens, then we'll have a bevy.
Yep, very much so. I'm very into the idea of Liverpool just stop doing your own head in, and most importantly, stop doing my head in. The manager, Cam, called them Tottenham this weekend's opponents the best counter-attacking team in Europe, which felt like one hell of a shout, considering the fact that, Aston Villa exist. But maybe you'll call them that in a few weeks. They are, though. They've got Kane, they've got Son, they've got Kulusevski. They've got Richarlison if they want to use him. And they will use him at some point over the course of the 90. It's a big test for the new approach, this, I think. And we'll keep saying that until something goes wrong. Let's be clear, I'll find my way to talking myself into the fact that Fulham are a big test for the new approach because Harry Wilson's on fire, that Brentford are a big test for the new approach because Tony Oran Bueno got great movement. But for now, Spurs can be a big test for the new approach, and they'll be looking to play in spaces. And they finished strong against United. They were terrible first half. For me, if we score first, we should be all right, but it's back to that if.
Yeah, it's what team turns up, and sometimes with us this season, you've known after 5 minutes what exactly is going to happen. But yeah, I think with Tottenham, it was made up yesterday when you seen them finishing strong, and then you remember, oh, we've got them on Sunday. It's a bit like, but I was, by Klopp's comment, I was thinking like, brilliant side, like, but I think, well, further up the pitch, but I was a bit like, he's giving them a bit like,
it's a lot of toffee, is what I would say. Yeah. I've heard toffee in the past. This feels like too much toffee.
Yeah, it was. And you don't know, I mean, if you come out and Spurs come out like a house on fire, it's a bit like, what are you doing there? Do you know what I mean? But no, to be fair, it's always going to be a good test. And it always seems to be a cracker with Spurs around fields. But I think we should have enough in us. And I think we're riding high in a lot of confidence at the minute. And if we just go in and just play as we normally do,
In the last three games.
I know, I did have to remember
that era.
The last seven halves.
I did have to remember that this season happens as well. So, yeah. No, if you, you know,
it's been a great seven halves of football, lads. I don't care what anyone says. Exactly, you can't take it away from us.
Our golden age.
Exactly. No, but yeah, I think should be fine for Sunday.
Are you confident we can replicate the form of the previous seven halves? Against the best counter-attacking team in Europe?
Exactly. When they got absolutely humiliated by Newcastle last weekend, you thought, we don't want to play them next because we don't want to be the team that they have to have a reaction
against.
And you and I together, we were going, Well, they got United's a good one for them to have a reaction. In a way, exactly kind of what we wanted to happen played out. I'm not sure I wouldn't rather they gone 2-0 up and then United...
Exactly, that's what I would have liked. But anyway, beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah, but another part of you's got to have your eye to business with United, that they come out of that game with their confidence significantly dented, I think. So I think we take what happened there. They have all their gifts are in their attacking positions. And I hope with our new flooding of the midfield with our new midfielder, Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Oh, yeah.
That we can press them so and control them so significantly that they don't get anywhere near counter.
So my thing is, I've seen the right-back Trent Alexander-Arnold play brilliantly against Heung-min Son on many an occasion, and I just hope he manages to replicate that performance.
I hope Heung-min Son is chasing Trent to the edge of his own at the edge of his own penalty.
As has happened before when the right-back Trent Alexander-Arnold has been brilliant against Tottenham.
Yeah. I'm just looking for some
solid... It's lovely
solid...
to see you. I'm glad. I love it when you come in. It's my favourite bit of this show when you come in.
We never see each other, do
we? No, we do. We never see each other. Indeed, there he is.
Oh, there we go.
Indeed.
Can we have that again, please?
It is, Rob, a big one. And it is about this machine being well-oiled and it working. Do you think he's going to make any changes? He mentioned Jota's had a bit of a knock. Konate was managed.
Did he?
Supposedly, yeah. Jota's had a little bit of a knock, but he expects him to be fit. He says that he ruled out Firmino and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, and they were the only people he ruled out.
He said he expected Konate to be fit and then decided best not risk him at all for West Ham, that was. So if he's... he's picked the same side now, virtually four on the spin, and this one has come... Was it a four-day gap?
Four-day gap, and they played last night.
So... He did. He vowed there would be changes in this run, and he's made virtually none, apart from the semi-enforced.
I think the Fulham team is going to be wild. I think he's not. He might change two. He might change Konate, and he might change one other for this in the front three, or possibly Henderson. And I think he's going to do six or seven for Fulham. Is my guess.
I think trying to second guess Klopp, you have to go in phases of Klopp. There are phases of Klopp where he picks more or less the same side, but makes two solid changes every game. And then he throws a mad one in, and the likes of Salah and Trent, who may have played all the way through, get rested. I don't know if it'd be quite that. I do think there'd be some change. Well, Konate's going to come in for Matip, which is the first change. Sounds to me like Jota will miss out. And the big question is, does he go with Nunes or does he go with Diaz, who was quietly very impressive? I feel the time that Diaz has had out, he might just be a bit nervy about starting him still. So I'm going to guess Darwin might get a start in this.
Scored against them and was excellent against them in the away game.
It was sensational against them, really. That was a sort of high watermark, really, in his season, in a sense. In midfield, are there any moves? Thiago hasn't started yet. It's been Fabinho, Trent and Henderson and Jones as the midfield three. It's hard to see. Maybe Thiago comes in for, don't know. Jones? I don't know. Don't want that.
Cam, what do you reckon?
Well, I was thinking maybe Henderson might not. I don't know. Then you've got Fulham after that. So it's like, Elliot? Is that where he'll have his rest?
No one runs out. My frustration at West Ham, I only had one frustration second half, Cam, is that no one runs outside Salah if Henderson doesn't play. So you end up, you've already congested the pitch, and then you congest it one more time if Henderson isn't there. And I found it frustrating. And it wasn't Thiago's fault. He came on, and he was Thiago.
Could Elliot
Someone had to go that side.
Sorry, could Elliot, to interrupt, but could Elliot come in from the cold? I mean, he's shown he's not scared of bringing in people like that. He's sort of Henderson's deputy in a sense.
Yeah, someone's got to make the pitch big on the right-hand side. And the only player who's really willing to do that, along with Salah at the minute, Henderson. So he's got to work out what that is, as far as I think, Cam.
That's my only one where I'm a bit unsure about who we might do. Because... but then going back to the other one, I think he'll do Nunes instead of Diaz, just for now, because just bringing Diaz, as Rob says, how long he's been out for, and just giving these little 15-20 minute cameos where he looks brilliant, by the way, but just the full 90's not there. But yeah, between Henderson and Thiago, I don't know, I really couldn't tell yet. And then they've still got a couple more days. You never know what might happen in the mysterious land that's Kirby, in terms of just, you know what I mean, anything could happen there. So
Keir, what do you reckon?
I think Konate is in for Matip, and I think Rob and Cam are right. I think Nunes starts, and I think, providing it goes well, you might see Gakpo come off on the 60 and Nunes go into the middle and Diaz come on the left and try and see what that looks like, because we haven't really seen much of that. And then, yeah, I don't think there's... midfield-wise, I'm again, I'm not too sure. But
he took Henderson off early, I think, you know, Keo, with one eye on the idea that Henderson will be starting against Tottenham.
Yeah, I think so, and I think the Fulham game is where you might see Elliott brought in from the quarter playing that position. So, yeah, Nunes, and then I think all going well and we're winning the game, you might see Nunes go through the middle and see what he looks like with Diaz alongside him. But I don't agree with Klopp's comments about them being the best pressing side, sorry, counter-attacking side in Europe, but we should be prepared to play the best attacking side and pressing side or counter-attacking side in Europe. We should be ready for anyone, so... Yeah, sure, we're up for it.
Fancies, Keo?
Yeah, fancies for every game now, Neil. I'm on that train. We're going to win every game, and then the summer's just going to be talking about how great next year is going to be.
Oh, well, I mean, what a summer it sounds like, sitting in trees, smiling at passers-by. Cam, fancy?
3-1, and then all attention to Monday.
indeed, it is worth pointing that one out. Rob, fancy?
What's happening on Monday?
On Monday? Oh, you know what's happening on Monday.
Blues-Leicester?
Leicester Blues.
The blue-off.
that's what they're calling it.
That's what they're calling it.
That's what the BT or Sky are doing all the stuff around it. They're saying it's the blue off.
Big blue Monday.
Yeah, it'll be tremendous.
So
tell you
much
what.
Work. I'm confident whilst being nervous simultaneously at the moment because I just don't want this dream run we're on to end.
There we are. Splendid stuff. Thank you to everyone who's been part of Tour Live this week. It's been a cast of thousands. We've been Laura, we've had Dan, and we had everyone involved with Wearing Colours, which is very kind of them indeed. Very hospitable to get there. Andy Heaton's produced. We've had Cam, we've had Keo, we've had Rob. And Rob, how does it feel to treat me like you do?
Sports Social Podcast Network.